Today on Straight Talk Africa, world leaders have gathered in New York for the United Nations General Assembly. They are addressing global concerns and discussing ways to find common ground on their grievances. That's coming up next, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Hello, welcome to special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Voice of America Studios in New York. It's Wednesday, September 30th. I'm Peter Clote in for Shaka Sali, who is on assignment.
Well, hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter from the Voice of America Studios in Washington.
Today, we'll talk about the 70th session of the General Assembly at the United Nations, and I'll bring you exclusive interviews with several African leaders who share their perspective on how the international body addresses the continent's problems.
And coming up later in our SCA inbox, we'll share your general thoughts on the UNGA through your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments. Hope you'll stay with us.
But first, U.S. President Barack Obama held numerous forums, addressed the entire body, and made several important announcements. My colleague Paul Sisko has more.
More than 200 world leaders and their delegations are in New York this week for the United Nations General Assembly. Conference rooms at the U.N. are bustling with activity as leaders meet to discuss key global issues on the sidelines of the UNGA. Most are pledging to do more to fight terrorism, climate change, and poverty.
Right now, some 800 million men, women, and children are scraping by on less than $1.25 a day. Billions of our fellow human beings are at risk of dying from diseases that we know how to prevent, and that is a moral outrage. It is a profound injustice. It is literally a matter of life and death.
The U.S. president hosted the Leaders Summit on Peacekeeping.
The United States will join with more than 50 countries to enlist new capabilities. Infantry, intelligence, helicopters, hospitals, and tens of thousands of troops to strengthen United Nations peacekeeping.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
The situations into which peacekeepers are deployed have never been more challenging as tasks multiply and we face extremist criminal groups and others who show no regard for international humanitarian or human rights law.
Over 100 countries now provide personnel supporting 16 ongoing UN peacekeeping operations. 70% of them are in Africa. Paul Sisko, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Now for more on this year's session of the General Assembly, I'm joined by my colleague Margaret Bashir, Voice of America's United Nations correspondent. Margaret, could you kindly give us a sense of the mood at the UN Secretariat so far?
Hey, Peter. Well, I would say it's a combination of reflection and urgency this year. Reflection because it is the 70th anniversary of the UN, so there's a lot of talk and speeches here about why the UN was established in the wake of World War II. And urgency because the world is facing an unprecedented number of crises from Yemen to the Sahel and countering terrorism in all its forms. So I think there, and climate change, I mean, there's just so many problems in the world today that they have to deal with.
Now, I understand there was a meeting on South Sudan, you know, with regards to the recent political and security crisis there. Could you tell us what transpired at the meeting?
Yes, the Secretary General held a high-level session on Tuesday, and he had, by video link, President Salva Kiir, and in the room he had Riek Machar and Pagan Amon and other international players who have, are stakeholders in South Sudan. And the Secretary General had some very strong, firm words for the leaders in that country. He said, "You're the newest country, and there is no reason for you to be at war. The whole international community stood by you and helped you get your independence, and now your leaders have taken you down this path, and frankly, I don't understand it, he said. And he told Salva Kiir in particular, you have a moral and political responsibility as the first president of South Sudan to lead your country down a path of peace. So he pretty much scolded them for the situation the country's in, and he told them to immediately adhere to the peace deal without delay.
Now, from what you sensed during the meeting, was there a commitment from both the government in Juba, led by President Salva Kiir, and rebel leader, former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar?
Yes. Salva Kiir said, look, I know I signed this deal with reservations, but don't see those reservations as conditions. See them as indicators of problems that we need to work out with the international mediators. But he did express his commitment to the deal, and so did Machar. But we've heard them express their commitment before. So this time the Secretary General said to him, don't betray us. Don't betray the international community. Stick to your word.
Now, Margaret, one of the significant issues at the moment is the issue of the ongoing migration crisis. Can you fill us in on this development and what people are saying at the UN General Assembly at the moment?
Well, today, momentarily, in fact, there's going to be a high-level session on the migration and refugee crisis. The Secretary General has organized this meeting as well, and it will have many of the important players on this issue, the Europeans, for instance, who are receiving the majority of the refugees that are coming from Africa and the Middle East and South Asia. And so the Secretary General said that we have to deal with this crisis in a humane way. We have to have long-term plan of action, and so they're going to discuss it this afternoon. Yesterday, I attended a press conference of the Hungarian foreign minister, and as you may know, Hungary has received tens of thousands of refugees in the last few months, and they have not necessarily been welcoming to them. And the foreign minister said that they had every right to build the fence that they built between the Hungary and Serbia to keep some of the migrants and refugees out. And he said that Europe shouldn't be the only country that takes the refugees, that because Europe has been discussing a quota system. He said the world should have a quota system and that all the major international actors should be required to take refugees and migrants. And he also suggested that the European Union should pay the bill, the humanitarian costs of all the refugee camps in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon that the UN is running. So, in other words, to keep the refugees in the region, because those the UN hasn't gotten enough money for a lot of these appeals. And so, for instance, the World Food Program has cut rations by 30% for some of the refugees, and this is spurring some of the migration. So he's saying the EU should just pick up the tab. It's over $8 billion this year, by the way, and they should keep the refugees in the region so they'll go home when the war is resolved. And he said he would present Hungary's plan today at the meeting. So we'll see what they say.
Thank you very much, Margaret. We have to stop right here. Thanks for sharing your insight on this year's UNGA. Now we'll pause for a short break. We would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website, Twitter, and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join in on today's discussion with your comments and questions. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOAUNGA70. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with my exclusive interview with the chairperson of the AU Commission, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma. Don't go away.
This year's theme of the UN General Assembly is to take action that urges members of the world body to double their efforts in challenges regarding peace, security, development, and human rights through sustainable development goals over the next 15 years. Here are a few of these goals. End poverty in all its forms everywhere. End hunger, achieve food security and improved nutrition also promote sustainable agriculture, ensure inclusive and equitable quality education, and promote lifelong learning opportunities for all, achieve gender equality and empower all women and girls, finally ensure availability and sustainable management of water and sanitation for all.
I wanted to present music and a side of American culture that is most important to me, that is a part of who I am. They're going to get some incredible performances. That's one of the things I love, bringing these artists in so you can get to see them do what they do. It's soul music, and that's what music is. It's that which comes from the soul.
Welcome back. Earlier this week, I caught up with AU Commission Chairperson Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma to talk about the organization's 2063 agenda, which includes women and youth empowerment. She also talked about silencing the gun in African countries, including Burkina Faso and the Central African Republic, or CAR.
Agenda 2063 is really a transformation agenda for Africa. For Africa's development, so that we can develop into a prosperous, peaceful, integrated, people-centered continent and really have a dynamic role in the world. It focuses on what are the comparative advantages in Africa and what are the constraints and how we can deal with them. In terms of what our comparative advantages are. First of all, it's our most precious resource, our people. We have the youngest population in the world as a continent, and it will continue being so into the foreseeable future. So this is a great asset we have, which we have to develop. And that's why our emphasis is on making sure our young people are healthy, but more importantly, that they are skilled. And we want to focus a lot more now on science, technology, engineering, and maths so that our young people can innovate, create jobs, and get decent jobs, both young men and women. We have to modernize agriculture. We have to move from using the handheld hoe to more recent technologies. We have to ensure that we build capacity within that sector, particularly for women, because 75% of people who work in the land are still women. So we need to give them better technology, access to finance, but also land rights, and improve agricultural productivity, and also stimulate industrialization by going into agro-processing and look at agriculture as a business rather than as an activity for poor women.
You talked about women empowerment. You're very passionate about it. What the year is almost coming to an end. Give me a rundown of things that you're doing to empower women on the continent, because they are the foundation blocks of the family. If they do well, the entire family does well. If they fail, Africa will be in trouble. So what are you doing?
We are running a campaign for girls to be kept at school as long as possible against child marriages. Because who gets affected by child marriages? It's the girls, and therefore the women who end up being in child marriages, and they grow up in a marriage without education, without the necessary skills. So that's a big campaign we are running. Secondly, we are running a campaign for girls to also go into higher education in the STEM areas. Thirdly, we are running a campaign to give women in agriculture better technologies like tillers and cultivators away from the handheld tool. We are looking at more practical things. We are looking at how to get the financial institutions to be more inclusive and give women access to finance. And we are saying, let's move away from this issue of microfinancing. Some women will need microfinancing, but we can't say women equal to microfinancing, microlending, micro this. There's nothing micro about women. They will also grow into small and medium enterprises, and we also want to see them in big companies. But the reason we stress so much education, not only for young people or young girls, but also for boys, is because education is the quickest equalizer. When you have somebody in a rich family and somebody in a poor family, if they become both of them become engineers, in a few years' time, you will not know the difference except for inheritance that the other might have. So education is a big equalizer, and even for girls, it will be so. So these are some of the practical things that we are looking at. And we are looking at, of course, decreasing diseases like malaria, which also affect children, but also a lot of women and others. But so these are some of the just practical things that we are looking at. We are wanting to have more women in decision-making, particularly in parliament and cabinet. This year we ran a campaign, and we were very happy to see that quite a number of people countries who had elections did get to the 30% threshold last year, year before, and this year. Of course, we're still behind. 22 countries in Africa have 30% or more of women in parliament. But comparing to where we were 20 years ago, this is huge progress. And so these are the practical things, how to help women to be councillors in the municipality, how to help them to be members of parliament. And the third thing, energy.
Right.
Sometimes people forget that energy has a lot of impact on the emancipation of women, because it makes a huge difference if you can make a cup of tea using your electric kettle than if you are to go and look for wood, make a fire and boil the water. It takes time, energy. So we want energy so that women can also be free to do more productive work. So all those things are the things that we are looking at for women.
Now, pragmatically, Madam Chairperson, what about the issue of the youth? Africa is very young. A lot of them can't find jobs. You initially said some of them are unskilled. How do you pragmatically change this paradigm?
Well, I think that's why we want it to be these skills. We are talking about skills revolution on the continent.
Right.
And that's why we want it to be incorporated into national plans.
Right.
So that countries know that skills are very important. Because if we skill our young people, my view is that they'll figure out to do with the rest. But if we don't skill them, they will end up on these boats in the Mediterranean trying to go and look for greener pastures. Yes, migration has always been and will always be, but it should be out of choice, not out of desperation. So for young people, we think skills are the most important. Secondly, the emphasis on industrialization is also about creating jobs for young people, because it's in the value chains that you create more jobs. So industrialization is critical for young people. We are also looking at education and harmonization of standards and so on, so that young people can move freely on our continent. Their education, their qualifications should be acceptable across the continent. So there is work going on around harmonization. So there are practical things that are happening. Of course, this is a big problem, it will not be solved overnight. But the important thing is that we're taking the steps now.
Wonderful. Madam Chairperson, talking about the migrant crisis, a lot of Africans are involved. And critics of the AU say the African Union hasn't moved quickly enough to help solve the root cause of the problems of political instability and the likes on the continent, which basically is a driving force to let these youth out of the continent to seek greener pastures. What say you about these criticisms?
You know, I think the AU cannot move into a country and take decisions about who citizens vote for and who they don't vote for. We can accompany, and we do that all the time, citizens in their quest for democracy, in their quest for good governance, in their quest for stability. So it's very important that we see peace and security as all our responsibility, not only the responsibility of the AU. Of course, we had, for instance, now we have a problem in Burkina, and there was a coup. The AU moved very swiftly to condemn the coup and to say if they remain in power, we will suspend them, they will not participate. But it is doable. And if the citizens also want democracy, it becomes easier. So it's a partnership that we must have with everybody, governments, civil society, voters in a country, and the AU. We can have peace if we all work together. Because the leaders must know that if they do not promote democracy and peace, citizens will not support them. But if citizens support them, what will the AU do?
No, we're talking about silencing the gun on the continent, which is a very passionate agenda of yours. What is the prospect of ensuring sustainability of peace and ensuring stability, ensuring that countries maintain their territorial integrity without being compromised on the continent in this drive of yours to silence the gun on the continent?
Well, it's not a drive of mine. It's a decision of the heads of state, which they took themselves, and I'm just running with it, but right. It's their decision.
Right.
I think it's important to at least have a desire and work towards silencing the guns. Misunderstandings, conflicts will always be there. Even in a family, they are there. But they are not solved through bloodletting. They are solved through discussions, dialogue, reconciliation. And that's what we are wanting to promote. That if there is a conflict, let's solve it through dialogue and through discussions and consultations, and not at the slightest misunderstanding we take out guns. But also, the agenda for development, skilling young people, industrialization, will also assist. Because if you have young people who are restless, unemployed, and they don't see a future, and somebody comes to them and says, okay, take these guns, let's overthrow these guys, I'll give you something. Of course, they'll run there. But if they have a job, they can see what their future holds, they will be very reluctant to be used by people who want to fuel violence and kill.
Talking about violence, we have the Central African Republic where sporadic fighting is still ongoing despite an imposed curfew. Do you care to comment on the situation this year?
Well, I think it's important for us to look at peace is not an event. Peace is a process. It doesn't mean that when you sign an agreement today, tomorrow there'll be peace. But it allows us to ensure that we hold parties accountable, to stick to the agreement. But also, we have to look at the UN peacekeeping. Because what is happening there? The UN peacekeepers are there. What are they doing to protect people? So I'm just saying we are in a progressive manner attaining peace in CAR. But of course, CAR for me is a very stark example of what happens if you don't develop the country and the people. Because if you go to CAR, just the capital, you can see that there hasn't been development in that country in decades. So it's not surprising that everyone who comes in gets cooled by another one and gets cooled by another one. It's not a good thing. We don't support coups, but there must be development. There must be people-centered development that will allow citizens to carry out their day-to-day lives without the desperation that you see there.
Africa likely to benefit from what you are hearing?
Well, first, let me say that Africa developed its own common position around this. So we already have a position of what we want to do. We also developed Agenda 2063, which is more comprehensive and more Africa-specific. And so what we are going to benefit is that there will be a global focus on the issues that we are dealing with. We can learn lessons from others. The global agenda is more or less the same, but we should remember that there are specific problems that other regions may not have. For instance, our youth. We are the youngest continent. We are the fastest growing population, but also the fastest urbanizing continent. So those things are very specific to Africa, and we have to make sure we address them. Skill our youth, as I said, industrialize. Without industrialization, there'll be no jobs for our youth, and without jobs for our youth, there will not be stability on our continent.
Lastly, the issue of reform of the United Nations Security Council, are you happy with the pace at which it is going?
With the pace? Where is the pace? It's going nowhere. No, I'm not happy because it's going nowhere. There's no pace at all. It's at a standstill, especially the Security Council reform. So I hope that as we celebrate 70 years, countries will take a firmer stand to say this situation is a situation that was addressing issues after the World War, and many countries were not there, and we cannot continue with it forever. It must change.
That was AU Commission Chairperson Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, who spoke to us earlier this week. You are tuned in to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more from New York in a moment. But first, here's Mariama Diallo. Mariama, it's all yours in Washington.
Well, thanks, Peter. Still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic feedback we've received from our audience through social media. But now, here is our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan in Nigeria.
Omunua Okugbo Igodalo from Abuja in Nigeria writes, "The United Nations can be more effective in helping Africa overcome its challenges by seeking out and working with civil society organizations that have a positive vision to transform the continent. Even with its team of efforts, the UN should not come to Africa as a body of know-it-alls. Rather, it should come as a partner in progress, willing to learn from Africans themselves about the unique values and viewpoints of Africans."
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
Welcome back to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa live from New York. Now let's go back to Washington. It's time again to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Peter. As world leaders discuss a myriad of major global issues at the United Nations General Assembly, African leaders are speaking out to emphasize and highlight their continental concerns and needs. This leads us to our question of the week, asking, what steps should the United Nations take to become more effective as an institution to help Africa solve its problems? Well, thanks for using all our social media platform to communicate to us. A reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOAUNGA70. If you haven't yet, please follow us on Twitter. Let's go to a tweet from Waziri of Taraku, who writes, let the global body go beyond talking or looking for what to gain, but help African leaders build strong institutions. Another one comes from Boubacar Ndiaye, and this guy has the same name as my brother. He says the United Nations funding should be centered on the Sustainable Development Goals because it's the fastest way to eradicate poverty and bring mutual understanding among countries. Let's move on to a Facebook comment from Freddie Kimuli from Kampala in Uganda, who writes, the UN has been looking the other way as dictators rule some African countries. Zimbabwe and Uganda are examples of such, but the UN has just kept praising them. We are tired of looking up to them. It's time for Africa to solve its problems. We will use Tunisia as an example and liberate ourselves from these dictatorial regimes. Well, another posting from William Kokulo from Monrovia, this time in Liberia, says, why can't the United Nations put a system in place that will stop African leaders from changing constitutions and staying in power past their term limit? Africa must respect its laws and regulations because disobeying these laws is creating conflict and impoverishing millions of people. Well, another Facebook comment comes from Richie Peza of Maputo in Mozambique, who writes, the solutions to the problems facing Africa are not found in the corridors of the United Nations. They are found inside Africa. Well, many different perspectives from all sides, but the most common point talked about by our audience has touched on term limits and respect on institutions. Not sure how much the UN can do on those issues, but at least your points have been heard, so let's keep the discussion going. And we'll have to leave it there for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. And if you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords, Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now, let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will join us. We'll discuss the recent peace accord and South Sudan's future. That's next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Thanks, Mariama, for bringing us our social media responses. Now moving on, in view of reports of tension in the southern African kingdom of Lesotho, I sat down with the recently elected Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi to talk about his coalition government and efforts to end concerns of political instability.
The coalition government that I lead is made up of seven parties. And if the 6 months that have passed is anything to go by, it is doing very well indeed. It's a coherent government. Of course, things move slowly because, as the expression says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, take others with you.
Right.
Yes, so things go slowly, but we are getting there.
What do you want the people of Lesotho to have in terms of improved, better living conditions and wages? How do you expect, or what do you want to implement? What measures, what policies are you implementing to improve the lives of the people of Lesotho?
Yes, the coalition government is premised on a foundational document called the coalition agreement, and that sets out the parameters and direction in which we want to or by which we want to take Lesotho forward in terms of improving the socio-economic situation in Lesotho. And paramount in that respect is job creation. Our nation is the young nation, with the vast majority of our population being young people. And it is critical that in the first place they be skilled to be able not only to seek jobs after qualification, but to create jobs themselves. We appreciate that we need official, ODA. We need FDIs. But we are also conscious of the fact that these efforts by our cooperating partners should come as an addition to our own efforts. We are clear that we need to pull ourselves by our own foot, by our own, as the expression,
bootstraps.
By our own, yes indeed, by our own bootstraps, yes. And in that direction, we have very clear policies in energy, for instance, energy generation. Lesotho is well poised to generate electricity using any one or all of the three clean energy sources: water, through which, or hydro energy, through which we already produce substantial amount of the electricity we used in Lesotho, but also through the second phase of the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, we will generate more electricity, more than our national requirements, so we will be able to export electricity.
So would you say the people of Lesotho have reposed confidence in your coalition government, looking at how competitive the election recently was?
I say so unequivocally, because we, as you know, have a mixed member proportional system, and the seven of us in government have 65 seats out of 120. So we command a clear majority, and therefore we do indeed have the confidence of the people that have elected us.
One of the things that came up during the election campaign is the ability to fight corruption in Lesotho. What is your stance on weeding out graft or fighting corruption in Lesotho?
Well, that is a very important issue for our government. We set up the anti-corruption, the Directorate for Economic Offences, which is an autonomous institution, and we are working very closely with them to strengthen them, to resource them, so that they can carry out their mandate without fear or favor.
There are concerns that in other parts of Africa, particularly, the anti-corruption agencies are used. Political pressure is brought on that particular institution to go after so-called political competitors or enemies, for that matter. What would be different in your stead?
Well, as I said, I used the word autonomous advisedly, and that is precisely what they are in terms of the law. So they have no business to take instructions from anybody. They are autonomous in their status and in terms of their mandate.
Lesotho, as a Southern African country, has seen a number of political instability. Some people have expressed concern about security and all that. How are you going to ensure that the territorial integrity of Lesotho is maintained?
I wish you could visit Lesotho.
Oh, I would be glad to do that.
And be able to see the situation on the ground for yourselves. Because we hear so much about insecurity in Lesotho, about instability, which we don't see on the ground. But it is something that is being peddled very much by the media, which is, of course, not really factual. Having said that, let me also hurry to say, I myself, after the unfortunate demise of Brigadier Mahau, I myself asked for SADC to set up a commission of inquiry into his unfortunate death. And not only that, I had actually asked them also to go back into other instances of insecurity, such as the January 2014 bombings at the house of the former Prime Minister's partner's house, and at the former Commissioner of Police's house or residence.
Talking about some of these happenings, your predecessor and his allies have gone abroad, self-imposed exile, complaining that there seemed to be a plot to assassinate them. And I understand you met him in South Africa to try to talk things over with him to come, and he set out some conditions. What are you doing about this?
I don't know if there was ever any plot to assassinate anybody in Lesotho. I'm not aware of such a plot. I have gone out to meet the former Prime Minister myself on two occasions. I've met him one-on-one, and we've had very fruitful, amicable discussions, and we have signed a memorandum of agreement in which he has undertaken to come back home. I offered him security by the Lesotho Mounted Police Service, with which he seems to be more comfortable than with the military. And I've offered him a government house to which he is not entitled, and which would be under guard 24 hours round the clock. And he's happy with those. So we are waiting for the Prime Minister to come back home.
Mr. Prime Minister, please clarify this. You said there are reports outside there to tarnish the reputation of Lesotho as a country of instability and all that. Yet, You enumerated instances of bombings, of raids, of people expressing concern about their personal safety and all that. Could you clarify that for me?
Yes. In the first place, the raid that I referred to of the 30th of August was an authorized operation by the military, and it had a specific objective which they carried out, and by 11 o'clock in the morning they had returned to the barracks. So that could not be seen as an instance of instability. But because of the allegation, the spurious allegation that there was a coup attempt, I had wanted that to be investigated by the commission. Yes.
Now, so far, where is the investigation at the moment? Are you abreast with the SADC investigation going on?
Yes, indeed. The commission was sworn in on the 10th of August, and it is proceeding with its mandate. I have appeared before the commission myself, and at very short notice for that matter. I was told at 8 o'clock in the evening to appear at 9 o'clock the following morning.
You were summoned.
That's right, and I obliged.
Right.
Yes, I obliged. And my Deputy Prime Minister Metsing has appeared and testified before the commission, and so has the Minister of Defense, and so has the commander of the Lesotho Defense Force and several of his senior officers. So, in as far as government is concerned, we would have no reason not to cooperate with the commission, as it is being alleged.
South African Deputy President played a critical role in trying to ease what some people claim to be tension in the country. What is the relationship between your country and Pretoria at the moment?
Very cordial indeed. Yes, we are neighbors that are closely, whose destinies are very closely intertwined in more ways than one. And we enjoy very good working relations with our South African counterparts. Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa came to see me 2 weeks ago, and we had very fruitful discussions. And last week, the South African Minister of Home Affairs was in Lesotho for discussions with his counterpart, and I also received him on and we had very good discussions on how to improve, cross-border, relations, so that because Lesotho is in a very unique position vis-à-vis South Africa, we are not only landlocked, but we are South Africa locked.
Right.
Yes. So we need to develop a special dispensation for our peoples to cross to and fro with ease, with minimum inconvenience, and of course for trade facilitation.
Some of your critics say that they wonder why you did not take packages that were given to you in your second and third term. What is your reason, Mr. Prime Minister?
Who gave me any package?
Well, that's what I heard. That's one of the accusations.
In the first place. No, I am in Parliament because I have won elections. I was Prime Minister for three terms because my party had won elections that were declared free and fair by all observers.
Including SADC.
Domestic, SADC, international.
What do you think the prospect of the government is?
I'm confident that we'll see our term through, our five-year term through. As I said earlier, we are a very coherent and government. We've course, we are very careful not to fall into the same pitfalls that our predecessors fell into. So everything being equal and normal, we will see our full term through.
That was the Kingdom of Lesotho Prime Minister Pakadita Musisidi. A reminder that you are tuned into a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from New York, bringing you in-depth coverage of this year's United Nations General Assembly. When we come back, I'll bring you Voice of America's exclusive interview with Kenya's head of state, Uhuru Kenyatta. Don't go away.
Here are more of the sustainable development goals that members of the world body were urged to address at this year's UN General Assembly. Ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all. Build resilient infrastructure, promote inclusive and sustainable industrialization, also foster innovation. Make cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, and resilient, and sustainable. Promote peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable development and provide access to justice for all. Finally, strengthen the means of implementation and revitalize the global partnership for sustainable development.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back. World leaders at the UNGA are calling for the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals, known as SDGs. Speaking exclusively to VOA, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta says in some countries, the Millennium Development Goals were somewhat achieved and that the SDGs will now set the agenda on the way forward. My colleague Esther Gitui Ewart sat down with Mr. Kenyatta and has this report.
Mr. President.
The Millennium Development Goals were effected in 2000 with high expectations that most countries in the developing world would achieve them by 2015. Their aim was to reduce hunger, poverty, disease, gender inequality, and a host of other socio-economic aspects. The Sustainable Development Goals are more ambitious, some calling for access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy for all, while also encompassing the earlier MDGs.
I think a lot of progress was made in terms of achieving a good number of the MDGs. And I think that is why the strategy now behind and the approach behind the SDGs is to look at the weaknesses that existed within the MDG framework and to see how we can strengthen that. And that is why a good part of the SDGs actually involves commitments within country, mobilizing resources domestically.
However, there are some critics who look at the Millennium Development Goals and say they did not achieve tangible results for most developing nations. People in these nations continue to suffer poverty, diseases, and hunger, partly because of poor policies, political conflicts, and natural disasters. But Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, was more optimistic about the MDGs.
I think, you know, that's a question of people always looking at the glass as if it is half empty instead of half full.
President Kenyatta's meetings on the sidelines of the UNGA include discussions with potential investors, and in part, these SDGs appear to link well with the Global Entrepreneurship Summit held in Nairobi back in July. Also, as part of U.S. President Barack Obama's Power Africa initiative, Sky Power, a U.S. company, signed a $2.2 billion agreement Friday to set up a solar energy research lab in Kenya. I asked Mr. Kenyatta what that means for Kenya's energy sector.
I think what is more exciting is their own commitment to upscale their own investment in solar energy in Kenya, which they committed to doing today by committing over a period of time to putting in up to about 2,000 megawatts of solar energy onto the grid, which we think is a magnificent and wonderful thing, and goes a long way to strengthening the kind of private public-private partnerships that we are looking for with the international community.
Pope Francis is heading to Kenya in November, and the president says his country is excited that the Pope's presence will go a long way toward bringing to the forefront some of the critical issues that are at the heart of the people, including a social and economic development agenda for the country.
Kenyans are excited about that particular mission, and I think the word of peace, the word of inclusivity that he is sending across the world, the need for religious tolerance, I think is a critical message at a particular stage in time that we are in. He is sending messages that I think are very pertinent to Kenya today, and indeed to the globe.
Mr. Kenyatta also called on Kenyans in the diaspora to invest back in their native country, saying he looks forward to facilitating their grand ideas to move Kenya forward. Esther Githui-Ewart, VOA News.
Thanks, Esther, for that report. We'll have to stop right here. I'm Peter Clotte, sitting in for Shaka Sali. He will be with you next week on Straight Talk Africa. For today's program, thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Batty. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to the special edition of Straight Talk Africa. I'm Peter Clotte in again for host Shaka Sali, who will be with you next week. Good evening from New York.